Trying to get in here because it saw you're not quite making it. Didn't hear a call sign or anything. This is N2 LDY monitoring.
Good evening. Time is 6:52 p.m. W2L repeater system.
Trying to do it on HT, and it's just, it's all noise, very little copy. All right, maybe we'll catch you later. K2KNB.
Hello, New York City. This is Papa Uniform 4, India Romeo Alpha. My name is Sydney. I'm from Brazil. I'm looking for two ham here in the New York City, KB2 Charlie Kilo Oscar, Mr. Tom, and Kilo 2 India Victor X-ray, Mr. Lam, and Mr. Steve. Are you there?
Pop Uniform 4 Station, this is K2KNB. I'm not familiar with the first person that you mentioned. The second one is Len, K2IBX, and can't tell you whether he'd be on or not on.
Okay, thank you, my friend. This is Papa Uniform for India Romeo Alpha. My name is Sydney. I'm from Brazil. I talked with these three men last week. And that's repeater. And now I'm looking for them. Okay? No problem. Please, before I go out, tell me what's your name, please.
Hi, Sydney. My name is Richie. And I guess it's 7 o'clock on a Sunday night. They could be out to dinner still. So just have to try them again. We have a net here at 8 o'clock. A tech net, so it's not something you would try then, but hopefully you'll catch them.
Okay, please. I forgot your name, my daughter. I have some problem here. Please repeat your name again.
Hi, Sydney. My name is Richie. Radio India Charlie Hotel India Echo. Richie.
Understood, Ricky. Understood, Ricky. And nice to meet you. Okay. I'm living in Brazil. I was born here. I'm trying to learn English, as you can notice. 7-3 for you and 7-3 for all of the people who are listening to me speaking right now here on the repeater. This was Papa Uniform 4, India Romeo Alpha 7-3 for you, Ricky, and bye-bye.
All right, Sydney, you're doing very well with your English. Much better than I would ever do with my Portuguese. Have a good night. Catch you again one day on the repeater or on HF, maybe. This is K2KNB.
KC2WGB, KC2YDT, out there, John? Negative contact, KC2YDT, clear.
Sound fine. I was just checking the 375 machine too, just in case we needed. Wanted to make sure I could make it.
Okay. 752-2, so it looks like we have 8 minutes left. And to HGN, standing by.
KC2WGB, standing by for the net. Thank you.
WLPZ Mobile, listening.
LPZ Mobile is KC2WGB. We're standing by for the TechNet. It's going to start in about 4 minutes.
And so LPZ will be clear right now. Bye-bye.
Good evening, you guys. I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2WGB. John and Dick attempt to organize this very enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings on 146.85, the Limonk repeater. And we discuss our favorite subject, ham radio, on the Technical Med. The tri-state area is what's covered by this particular repeater, portions of New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. A lot of brain power in that area, and we try to tap into that brain power. Hopefully, as people ask questions, someone in one of those areas has experience and gives us the benefit of his experience by signing in and saying, this is how it really works. We try to figure out how antennas work and how propagation work and how transmission lines work and transmitters and receivers and filters, duplexers. My goodness, there's a long list of fairly exotic pieces of hardware that are used in the wireless world of ham radio and broadcast. And so step by step, we try to teach each other how these things work, how to make them work better, how to make it more performance out of our towers, our antennas, and so on. The grounding systems we use, lightning protection, what does standing wave ratio really mean? Tonight we might get into discussing what does group delay really mean and phase delay, particularly of filters and transmission lines. A person signs into the Technical Net, meaning he does have a question or a comment, by giving me and John your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not just sign in because you're listening. After 29 and a fraction years, we believe somebody's listening. This is TechNet number 1409 of the series that began in September of 1982, 29 and a half years ago. The last 6.5 years of the Technical Net are recorded by a very enthusiastic guy in New Jersey named Mike Perry, KC2NJI. And you can listen to all of those recordings by going to the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website, you can choose a year, a weekend, so to speak, a year, a date, an hour, and you play back those reels 1 hour at a time, and you'll hear the sound of the past TechNets. Mike is kind of busy lately, and he hasn't been documenting, but on previous years, every 10 minutes of the TechNet, what subject is being discussed is listed on that website. So if you wanted to know about the Smith chart, for instance, you could go to the particular days and weeks where the Smith chart was being discussed and play all those back. There are college professors in the New York City area who have been telling, in some cases, been telling their students, if you want to get a real flavor of what the wireless world is like beyond what we expose you to in the academic world, listen to the Technical Net or listen to those recordings. So we believe it's educational. Okay, a typical sign-in would sound like this. K2KNB, Rich and Yes. He happens to be the president of the club. Anyone to check in, please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes at this time. K2RIW listening. Hey, John, looks like we just pack up and go away this week. One more call. Anyone out there with a question or a comment tonight? Give me your call letters and name.
WS2N Space Report. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, John.
That was Paul, our space expert. I should have mentioned the fact that our usual schedule is that we take questions and we try to give people at least brief answers during the first hour of their particular question. At the end of that hour, John goes to the mailbag, which used to be called Mel's Corner, is now called John's Corner by me, in which people who don't have their ham license yet or don't have the equipment yet, by which they can get onto the TechNet and speak to us live, mail in by either snail mail or electronic mail to John what their question is. We take about three of those each week. Majority of what the TechNet is a live give and take on the air. John and I are, in general, not volunteering a free written consulting service that's a little bit above and beyond the call of duty. But when it comes to live question and answers, we do our best. So the first hour, we try to answer as many questions as we can. Then we go to the mailbag, and then Paul tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And after that, we go into deeper subjects. Anyone who would like to check into the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
K2MMY, Ray, yes, with a question if my battery don't die.
Very fine, Ray. Hope your battery doesn't die. And one last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now.
Kilo Delta 2, Chucky got lucky. Robert, yes.
KD2.
Last night got resolved.
The last person who signed in, please repeat. Robert, we got you. Who was the person who signed in by Echo Link?
KE2EJ. I'm wondering if Glenn convinced you of his thoughts.
Good question. Eric, we had quite a discussion late last night. All of a sudden, I'd forgotten what the subject was. But we partially convinced each other, I think, but I'm not sure.
Oof. Lightning.
Oh, yes, lightning. How fast is the rise time of lightning? How long? How many durations and so on? Lightning is a complicated subject. One last call. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me a call letters and name right now.
KC2WGV. Good evening, Dick. Well, everyone on the net. Couple from Mel's mailbag. Plus, Dick, if we have time, I have a question on X-rays, an experiment I'm building. So if we have time, after Paul. KC2WGV. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, John, we're going to make time for you. Okay. Ray, KC2, Mike Yankee. Hope you got a spare battery. Go right ahead with your question, Ray.
Okay, Dick, you said in the past the radio wave, when you have a transmission line and an antenna, that the radio wave kind of ignores the transmission line and only sees the antenna, and so that you get away with that. And I was wondering why that's true, because I know you can use a transmission line for an antenna, you know, or in place of an antenna. So how is the incoming sine wave able to ignore transmission line? Is it because there's a mismatch in impedance, or what's going on there?
A little bit afraid, Ray, that I only partially understand your question, but I'm going to try to restate it and see if it's what you're saying. I've often said that a receiver is extremely forgiving. In the case of 80 through 10 meters, in other words, 3.5 megacycles to 30 megacycles, on most receivers, you take a random length of wire, connected to the center conductor, if it's a UHF connector on the back of the radio, and turn on the radio, and you're going to get reasonably good reception. You won't get a whole lot of S-meter deflection, but you'll hear lots of things on the band. You try to transmit back through that random length of wire with no transmission line, and it'll work very, very poorly. The guy next door, you hear you, but not much further down the block, so to speak. So receivers are very forgiving. If the transmission line is properly balanced and E-field-wise at right angles to the antenna, like a horizontal dipole and a piece of feed line coming off of it vertically with a balun, the radio wave doesn't see the transmission line at all. And if that's what you're asking, I can explain that one, Ray. KC2MMY for a little more clarity on the question. K2RIW on the TechNet. You got it, Ray.
Roger, I think that's what I'm asking. In other words, you're cutting your antenna along the dipole, ignoring the transmission line, essentially, and why doesn't that count? Is it
towards that 90 degrees. That's what my question is. Why isn't that part of the receiving antenna where you would cut the length? How is that? I guess I'm asking it right now. I guess you know what I mean. How is it excluded?
Very fine, Ray. I'm getting a little more of the question, a little bit more of the picture in your mind of what you're asking. When it comes to a signal that is horizontally polarized, and if you and I are setting up a horizontally polarized dipole, the wire of the dipole is parallel to the ground, you could say the radio wave is looking for a horizontal piece of wire, and for a whole bunch of reasons, it will completely ignore a vertical piece of wire. And the transmission line coming off of the antenna, if it has the proper kind of a RF choke or balloning device right at the center of the dipole, so that you're not feeding some RF energy back down the outside of the coax cable, in that case, your vertical piece of transmission line has no substantial amount of horizontal metallic extent. The radio wave is looking, in the case of 80 meters, you could say the radio wave is looking for a piece of horizontal wire roughly 131 feet long, parallel to the ground. That's what the radio wave is looking for. The E field is horizontal, and it's looking for a horizontal piece of wire where the E field can climb onto the wire as that radio wave passes by your backyard. I'm putting it kind of simplistically, but I think you can see what's going on. If I made that dipole 1 inch wide instead of 131 feet long, and I didn't do something fancy to re-resonate it, the amount of signal pickup would be zero, damn close to zero. Well, your coax cable, when it's vertically coming away from the dipole, it's got a horizontal metallic extent of about an inch, half an inch, three quarters of an inch, depending on what diameter cable you're using. So a vertical piece of mast to support the dipole, like your tower, even the tower with a 1.5 foot width to the tower, that vertical piece of metal is very small compared to the horizontal beam width it's looking for, 131 foot long piece of wire. Of the dipole itself.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So if you're talking about conventional antennas with conventional half-wave resonance, then you want that piece of wire to be a half wavelength long in the right polarization of the signal you wish to receive. And that transmission line has no effect on that if the transmission line is properly isolated by way of a balloning device or a couple of turns of the coax cable taped together near the dipole as an RF choke. Because when you're transmitting, for instance, the radio wave wants to balance itself, half of it on the right-hand side of the dipole, half of it on the left-hand side, so there's real voltage on the left-hand side. The left-hand side is the one that you've soldered to the shield if you do it with a very simple installation. Therefore, you're relaunching some signal onto the cable, and in that case, you're now, when you're transmitting, launching some signal vertically polarized onto your transmission line, and so your signal you're transmitting would be a little bit more complicated. But once you add that RF choke or balloning device, that stops happening, and it stops happening both on transmit and receive. So it's the amount of wire of the right polarization the signal is looking for. Maybe that helps, John. Now, here we go. Ray. KC2MMY, hang in there with that battery, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick, I don't know if you can hear me. I guess that's a pretty good explanation. There's two things. If you don't have a balancing device and you're 90 degrees to the antenna, those two conditions would then start to give you problems. Over.
Yeah, if you took the transmission line that's coming away from the dipole, and a foot away from the dipole, you make a right-angled bend, where now the transmission line lies parallel to the dipole itself. Once you do that, the transmission line now starts picking up some of the signal when you're receiving, or transmitting some of the signal when you're transmitting. When you're transmitting, for instance, the two halves of the dipole both have RF voltage on them. If your transmission line, a good portion of it is laying parallel to the dipole, the capacitive coupling between the real dipole and the transmission line means by capacitive coupling, you're launching some signal onto the transmission line, onto the outside of the coax cable. And particularly if the coax cable happened to be a resonant length between the dipole and the shack, you could get some funny effects. It's not a showstopper. It's just less than ideal, and you will get coupling. You could, in a pinch, if you're setting up a dipole on a temporary location, you're at a motel site, you're at a campground or whatever, and for mechanical reasons, you're forced to lay the transmission line partially parallel to the dipole. It doesn't stop it from working. It's just that the transmission line is now going to be picking up some of the signal when you're transmitting or receiving, and it'll behave a little bit differently. It won't stop it from working. It'll just make the radiated pattern a little bit more complicated. You might have some RF energy in the shack, so to speak. In the worst case situation, when you're using your metallic D104 microphone and you're transmitting 100 watts of power, as your lip touches the microphone, you might sense a little bit of RF energy there, if you had that condition. But not many of us run into that. Don't lose a whole lot of sleep about it, Ray. It would still work. It's just less than perfect. KC2MMY.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2MMY, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'll wait for the beep, Ray.
Okay, Dick, I guess we'll take that for an answer. I could probably go on all night. But it sounds, it's a lot more understandable now. So thank you. I don't want to hold up the segment. K2MMY with K2RW in the segment.
You're into a pretty good subject area there, Ray. If we got some spare time left over before 9 o'clock, you're allowed to re-ask the question. You're allowed to come back next week and re-ask the question. In the more deep area beyond, let's say, 9:30, 10 o'clock, you're allowed to re-ask the question. So the fact that we've given you partial answers and you got more questions about it, don't worry. Come on back. How nearby metallic objects, whether they be feline, support structures, part of the bed spring that supports a number of antennas, if you're putting up a lazy H or four separate Yagis, nearby metallic objects that are horizontally polarized, vertically polarized, long, short, and whatever, good subject to discuss. The way I normally discuss it is that if your horizontal dipole is, let me pick a number, 60 feet off the ground, and directly across the street from you is the Con Ed powering or the LIPA powering, their wiring, and it's also exactly 60 feet off the ground, and is exactly to the northeast, the direction you want to talk to your buddy in London, good common sense would lead you to believe that that wiring of the power company, directly at the same altitude as your antenna, directly across the street, you would think it's going to give you a blockage, and you think your buddy in London is not going to be able to hear you. Not at all. That wiring from Con Ed, except for some static it might create if they've got an arcing insulator, that wiring across the street has almost no effect as long as it's a non-resonant length rate. Your 80-meter dipole, if your eyes operated at 80 meters, and that dipole is at resonance and operating normally, and you looked down the throat of that dipole, you would see a great big black oval in space, which is a little bit beyond the tips of the dipole and quite a bit of width, one-third of the width of the dipole, so to speak. One-third of the length of the dipole would be the width. You'd see this huge oval in space, 8,500 square feet of material, of air, so to speak, around that dipole would be sucking up the signal. That's the real effective area of an 80-meter dipole at a reasonable altitude off the ground, sucking up energy from 8,500 square feet. All of that energy appears onto the wire, goes down the feed line, and eventually moves the S-meter on your receiver. The local wiring across the street has a couple of square feet of shadow it's casting onto your antenna, if it is non-resonant. That's the magic of resonance. If that wiring just happened to be the right length with egg insulators or whatever on the Con Ed wiring, yes, you'd be building a Yagi and all kinds of funny things can happen. But that non-resonant wire casts a shadow onto your effector area of a couple of square feet. You've got 8,500 square feet on 80 meters.
for that particular dipole. It gets smaller as you go to higher bands with shorter dipoles. Let me drop. And therefore, with good instrumentation, laboratory instrumentation, you try to measure how much shadow you're getting from that Con Ed wiring across the street. And if you had the wherewithal, you have them now remove that Con Ed wiring and you make a measurement of the signal strength from your buddy from London. I don't think you'd be able to see the difference. Tell that to the average ham radio operator. He thinks that blockage is going to kill him in that direction. Absolutely not. It may make some ignition noise, and he may need a fancy noise blanker in order to tolerate it. But once you start studying antennas from an effective capture area, which is not well covered in the books, an awful lot of the funny characteristics start making a lot more sense. So when you put up horizontal masts and pipes and support structures for your Yagis, if it's non-resonant, it has very little area to it. Only the physical area you see and the real radio area of your antenna at times is a great big number, and you'd be amazed how immune it is from those shadows. Let me pass it back to you for a quick comment on that, Ray. And if it didn't make sense at first, you're in good company. KC2 MMY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm going to...
Hey, Dick, hope you can hear me. Yeah, you cleared up a lot there. I have to swallow that and process it a little bit. And it kind of leads to other questions about MP matching, why there's a need for it. But again, I don't want to be sucking up all the time. So if you can hit that at another time or later, I'll let you go to the next guy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, there's a lot of magic that goes on with impedance matching, Ray. Another extremely good question that's highly misunderstood. If we got some time tonight, we're going to be discussing that further. Lots and lots of guys have a lot of problem with that. I've been operating as a consulting electronic engineer, radio designing engineer, for lots of years, and I can tell you for a fact, 90% of what an antenna designer does when he's designing an antenna is find out what he's got to do mechanically, electronically, physically, in order to get a good impedance match with a low enough standing wave ratio across enough megacycles of where that particular piece of electronics has to operate. Impedance matching is where antenna engineers spend 80 or 90% of their life solving that particular problem. And the books do only a mediocre job of explaining what's really happening. And I can add to it, and I can make it clearer, it says here. And so later on we'll get into that one, Ray. Hope we can get a chance to get back to you. Robert's the next person on our list. KD2, Charlie Golf Lima, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Robert.
Okay, KD2, CGL. Now, one of the practice exam questions in the extra class is which HF frequencies typically support long path propagation. Now, I put down 30 meters to 10 meters. That was one of the four possibilities. And lo and behold, the answer was, according to this practice question thing, 160 to 10. I was a little shocked when I saw 160. I said, long path? Really? This can't possibly be. Is it possible?
There, I'm not an HF guy. I'm not a guy with a whole lot of HF experience, Robert. Possible, yes. A good guy called me up, and I got to go find his call letters, from California, who's trying to get 5-band DXCC, and he's got it on all bands except 80 meters. 100 countries, in other words. He wants 100 countries on every band, and so long path, short path, he needs everything. If the ionosphere is properly supporting you, I don't think there's any limit. But now the ionosphere has got to give you good reflection on that particular frequency, low absorption from the D layer on that particular frequency, low precipitation static. In other words, not a whole lot of thunderstorms that are giving you a whole lot of excess noise. So
when you choose the right day of the year, the right day of the sunspot cycle, the right day weather-wise, I see no reason why all of the HF bands are not capable of long path and short path, capable of. Now, you talk to the guys, you talk to those guys who really use each one of those bands, I guarantee they're going to tell you that, yeah, I can get long path 5% of the time on this band, but only 1% of the time on that band. Yeah, it's possible on that band, but it's kind of rare. You're going to get a whole lot of answers like that. So what's the chances on any one particular day you're going to be able to get long path and short path and maybe simultaneously? I think it's kind of low. But when Mother Nature's ionosphere wants to reflect that signal for you, when she's got the right amount of ionization and the right amount of polarization characteristics, and when that signal goes through the ionosphere, your horizontally polarized signal that you're transmitting might twist a few times, and by the time it gets to London or Africa or Japan, it's twisted a few times and turned out to be vertical or slant 45 to the right polarization. Faraday rotation, that's called. The mixture of the Earth's magnetic field plus the plasma that you and I call the ionosphere, it does this twisting of the signal. Another thing that's not very often mentioned. So does the long path and the short path twist the same way? No, they do not. And that Faraday rotation doesn't obey reciprocity. If I get two turns of twist to the right when I go from New York to London, am I going to get two turns of twist to the left when I go from London to New York? The answer is no. It's just the funniness of a Faraday rotation. It doesn't obey Faraday. A Faraday rotation doesn't obey reciprocity. It doesn't behave in exactly the same way when you send the signal back, if you know what I mean. So, as I said, I'm not an HF person. The people on frequency who have a lot of HF experience, please give me your call letters right now and tell us what you think about long path and short path, which of the ham bands can do it. Long path, by the way, means if I wanted to go to London, London from here is probably 3,300 miles, a great circle path.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's probably 3,300 miles by great circle path directly from New York to London by the signal being launched to the northeast from here. Okay? If I launch the signal to the southwest and I go all the way around the backside of the Earth, over Australia, so to speak, and then come back into London by way of going over Russia. That's the long path. Much longer in miles. The signal in general is going to be weaker when it gets there, but there's ways of confirming that it's doing that. If you had a good beam on the particular band you're using in London, you may be able to aim it the other way, and the same thing with the beam you've got in New York, aim it the other way, and pick up the long path signal. So people who have got experience with long path versus short path on each of the major HF ham radio bands, if you've got that experience and got some, it can tell us about what it's like, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2PJF, Vito Bayshore.
There's a HF man from way back. Hey, Vito, how often have you seen long path? What bands have you seen it on? How popular is it? Tell us whatever you know on that one, Vito. You got it, Vito.
Okay, I'm mainly a CW nut, and most of my activity that I do, the bands that I band, more than one, that I frequent, is 20, 40, and 80 CW. Now, from my understanding over the many years that have passed, there's a bell-shaped curve, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, when I've been studying, that starts at way down, very, very ultra-high frequencies, and works its way up to the top of around 14 megacycles, which is 20 meters, and then works its way down again, down to 160. And as you go from the ultra-high to the ultra-low, the range shortens. And I've learned, let me drop. What I have learned, let me use that language, that the peak of performance is usually around 20 meter band. And from my operating on CW, I have found I get the most results long-range communications around the world, more so and quite more easily, this is Vito talking now from my experience, on the 20-meter CW portion of the spectrum. Now, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think there's a lot going on there, Vito. First of all, when a guy uses Morse code instead of sideband, in theory, he can use a much more narrow filter. He could use a 500 hertz or a 300 hertz bandwidth filter. So he's getting much more selectivity. He's getting much more signal-to-noise ratio for the guy transmitting the same amount of signal. And the filter I'm speaking about might be the filter you dial in your receiver because you bought a premium filter. If you've got a whole lot of experience, the filter we're talking about is the filter between your ears. Your brain, you can tune your brain for your favorite CW frequency. Maybe you set the tone at 800 hertz, and the brain can be tuned so that it's got a 70 hertz equivalent bandwidth. You can tune your head to listen to an 800 hertz signal, for instance, 70 hertz bandwidth around there, and essentially ignore everything else. So the real filtering of the system, in many cases, inside the guy's head. Whereas when you're listening to single sideband, to really get all the voice the guy is saying, you need a good 2 kilohertz of bandwidth. So you get a huge advantage along those lines with Morse code, CW. The angle of bounce. In other words, if you've got an antenna that's got the right altitude, so it's launching a substantial amount of signal, very parallel to the Earth, so it hits the ionosphere at a very gradual grazing angle. You get a hell of a lot more bounce. Very similar to what happens when you look at the glass on a storefront window. If you look at it at a grazing angle, the window, the glass is almost a mirror. You look straight on, it's nowhere near as a mirror. Well, the ionosphere has the same kind of Brewster angle effect. It's not really the Brewster angle, but it has a little bit of relationship to it, the Brewster effect. So the ionosphere at low angles gives you a much longer skip. And in other words, the very first hop goes a large number of miles. So the combination of using the maximum usable frequency, low angle antennas, gives you more and more probability and Morse code, which allows you to listen to weaker and weaker signals. You put it all together, long path and short path are much more likely to occur when you use those particular things to your advantage. As I said, I can't think of the call letters of the man in California right now, but there's a guy who is looking for, and this is slightly related, he's looking for a good location in the New York, New Jersey, New England, Connecticut area where he can come and finish off his 5-band DXCC. In the case of 5-band DXCC, as long as all of the contacts take place from the continental United States, whether he makes the contact from California or New York, doesn't matter. In his California QTH, he has a whole lot of local noise that's giving him a lot of trouble on 80 meters. He's got 5-band DXCC on every band from 40 meters up. He just doesn't have it all on 80 meters. He lacks quite a few countries. So he's looking for a good location in the New York area where he can come and supply the antennas if need be, as long as you've got enough property that he can put up a good 80-meter invert.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Where he can come to your particular QTH, because you've got enough property and you've got enough time to let him do it, he'll supply the hardware to put up the 80-meter dipole, the inverted V, whatever, slingshot through the trees, but he wants to do operating from an East Coast location. There are more countries that has reasonable mileage to pick up his missing countries. He wants 100 countries on 80 meters. He's got it on all other bands. So he's looking for a location in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, New England area where he can operate from to finish his 5-band DXCC. And sounds like he's an awful nice guy to meet. And he's doing this in his retirement, if you know what I mean. So that's slightly related to long path and short path. So that's sort of what we know about it, Rob. I guarantee there's a lot more to it. I imagine if you Google those words, You'll find more by way of the internet. And I wonder what you found out so far. And as you find out more about this long path versus short path, Robert, particularly if you were pursuing 5-band DXCC, you'd care about it, because some of those countries, maybe you triple your chances of getting 5-band DXCC if you include long path and short path. So as you find more about it, please come back and tell us what you found. KD2, Charlie Golf Lima, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Kilo Delta 2, CGL. From what I understand, the only way that I can ever determine that I am experiencing long path would be if I had a nice 20-meter beam, and I just happen to notice that I am not receiving England to the northeast, but I am actually communicating with England to the southwest. Well, that's pretty obvious that I'm experiencing long path, given the right time, frequency, conditions, etc. Now, here's the question. They said the right answer was 160 to 10 meters. You can experience long path in this extra class practice exam sample question. Now, you would have to have a rotatable 160 meter beam. As we all know, this is, well, dream on. This is probably totally impossible. So how else would you ever know that you are experiencing long path on 160 without a full-size three-element or two-element rotatable 160-meter beam? I know they do have them for 80 meters. There's a guy in Russia on YouTube that has a three-element 80-meter rotatable beam. Very nice. But on 160, oh boy, back to you.
WJ2B with Commerce.
Yeah, I know a solution to this one, Robert, but let me go over to WJ2B first. Let's see at how he has a solution to it. Go right ahead.
Good evening to everyone on the net, WJ2B out here in Smithtown. And yes, I have experienced a long path reception on 80 meters. I'm an 80-meter person. I have a full wave, 270-foot-long triangular-shaped loop antenna in my backyard, and I have, on very, very rare occasion, heard people coming in simultaneously short and long path on 80 meters, and there's a very, very slight delay, almost like an echo, being in an echo chamber when you hear the long path come in. So you can tell, but you hear both of them at the same time pretty much, and you hear a very, very slight delay, so that's how you can tell WJ2B.
Yeah, Joe lives in Wisconsin, and so listening to that delay, if you were talking to a guy in London, 3,000 miles short path, and 21,000 miles long path, and 21,000 miles is going to give you a significant number of milliseconds of delay, long path versus short path. So as the guy is transmitting Morse code or sideband, that time delay and its slight echo, you're going to hear that. That's one approach. There's another approach here, Robert, and that is you don't need a full three-element rotatable beam on 80 or 160 meters to confirm. You can build a wire beam. In other words, if you've got the property to put up, let me give an example, an 80-meter dipole. I've got enough trees on the property, I've got an acre of property, and so as long as I lay out the dipole in a somewhat diagonal angle that favors, say, London, in my case, so the broadside is toward the northeast, I can lay out another dipole-like structure, maybe a tenth of a wave or two-tenths of a wave to the northeast, and as I bring that extra piece of wire into resonance, above resonance or below resonance, it will be a director of a Yagi. A wire Yagi works like a charm. So if the wire is the right number of wavelengths away and the right number of wavelengths shorter, maybe it's 90% of the length, so that it's a little bit shorter and it's now acting as a director. Or if I make it a little bit longer, it's acting as a reflector. By having a separate piece of transmission line going to that second dipole, you've got two or three choices here. I can feed both dipoles as a phased array, and a phased array always fires in the direction of delay. So by delaying the signal on the dipole that's closer to the northeast, compared to the main dipole. I'm directing the signal in that direction, and if I then...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If I then reverse which one is delayed, I can favor one direction versus the other. I'll bet you with a pair of dipoles, I'll bet you I can easily get 10 or 15 decibels of front-to-back ratio, and I can electronically decide, do I want the signal to go long path or short path? The stepper antenna uses these characteristics. You can reverse the direction by changing the length mechanically. You can change the length electronically. In other words, by putting inductors or capacitors on the end of the transmission line on the parasitic dipole, I can tune it as a reflector or as a director. By feeding signals to both dipoles, I can use it as a phased array. So electronically, and there's at least two or three different ways electronically, I can create a front-to-back ratio, and I can flip the direction of transmission. If you and I had, let me drop. If we had the wherewithal, like that guy in Japan who's got this 180-foot-long boom, five-element, fully rotatable 80-meter beam on top of this huge apartment building in Japan. It looks like it's a five-story apartment building, and he's got this huge antenna on top. He must own the apartment building, or they'd never let him do that. I guarantee it takes him 60 seconds to rotate that thing. Electronically, when you make a dual dipole, and maybe even a triple dipole if you want to get fancy, you can electronically flip between the two in milliseconds. It takes him 60 seconds to rotate that thing. By the time he rotates that darn thing, the propagation has changed, the guy has gone off from transmit to the receive mode, and so on. So if you had the rotatable antenna, it wouldn't be anywhere near as good as electronically switching. But you can electronically make a front-to-back ratio, and it takes very little extra real estate to do it, as long as you've got enough trees to support this second piece of wire. I think you see where I'm going in this one, Joe. You can have a lot of, Robert, you're going to have a lot of fun with this one. Phased arrays, those kind of antennas, is one of the areas where we amateurs have done rather little. The military has done a lot. We can do a lot more, and once you understand the theory of operation, it doesn't require a kilobuck to do it. KD2 CGL, K2RIW in the TechNet. Guarantee you're going to have more questions on this one downrange, Robert. Go ahead.
Okay, just one last comment, because that difference, that echo, that's a good indication that, yes, even with a humble dipole, that you are experiencing a long path. That's good. That was a good answer. Here's another thing I just remembered. I think there's a company that is heavily into phased verticals, and I'm not sure if it's DX Engineering. I can't remember. But you can take, that would be your best way to do this, because, let's face it, 160 is big. And I'd sooner deal with a quarter wave vertical than a half wave on 160. You can make a phased array of quarter wave verticals, which have a low rank angle of radiation, which is always good for DX. And you can electronically rotate that. And I think they either make, you can have two verticals or three or even four that you can phase electronically. That would probably be the easiest way, considering the vast size of the antennas at 160. So that's all I really have to say, and you guys did a great service in answering my question. Kilo Delta 2, Chucky Got Lucky, out.
I slightly disagree with you, Robert. To set up a good high-performance single ground plane radial on 160 meters requires a pretty tall tower and a whole lot of ground plane radios just for one of them. And now you want to set up three or four of them in order to make a phased array. That's a pretty big investment in hardware, dollars, and whatever. In the case of dipoles, simple wire in the air is very low in cost. To put up multiple dipoles with multiple feed lines, each dipole's got a feed line going to it, and properly arranging them, bringing them into resonance above or below, making it a director or reflector, or feeding them simultaneously as a phased array, guaranteed us very few dollars, doesn't require ground plane radios, and the dipole in the air is one of the big secrets that's very well kept, Robert, and I'm going to tell you and not going to let anybody else on the net know about it. I'm having some fun with you. The dipole in the air does not have to be full half wavelength long. You can put up an 80-meter dipole because you got enough room for that and feed it beautifully on 160 meters. You got to put some kind of an impedance matching device. A remotely controlled relay in a box alongside of the dipole would be the efficient way of doing it so that you can electronically switch your 80-meter dipole into 160-meter resonance where you're not changing its physical length. You're changing its electronic length with that network you've got in the box with the remotely controlled relay right at the dipole. That's one approach. If you're willing to use very low-loss open wire line, 600 ohm line, then all that electronic switching can be done in the shack. Yeah, the cable's going to run high vis-war when you're on 160 meters, and that's why you're going to run 600 ohm line so it can tolerate the loss. So you can do the electronic switching in the shack. So, yes, you will have more...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You will have more narrow bandwidth when you take that 160... When you take that 80-meter dipole, in this example, and feed it on 160 meters by electronically resonating it on 160, it will be high in Q, it will be narrow in bandwidth. Every time you QSY 10KC up the band, you're going to have to do a fair amount of retuning. But, and you can, when you take the 80-meter dipole and use it on 160 meters and properly resonate it electronically, you will get 95% performance. There's a whole lot of guys out there on the 20-meter band that are going to tell you that when the dipole is too short, it's going to have too little capture area, and it's going to have too low a gain, and it's going to have too low a efficiency. Absolutely not true. But they're saying it's good common sense. Antennas do not behave that way. An antenna radiates well if it resonates. You resonate it first, then it can radiate. The signal is going to be bouncing back and forth in any antenna that you build of reasonable size, and what resonance means is you're making all of those bounces stay in step with each other, stay co-phase, so you can electronically resonate that 80-meter dipole on 160. You can put up a pair of them, very inexpensive in materials, just another set of trees to support it, a little bit more rigmarole in the way you feed it, and there's multiple ways you can do it, and now you can have electronically switchable front-to-back ratio in a fraction of a second. Therefore, you can first study the forward signal and the reverse signal, find out which is stronger, and know whether or not the long path is today 10 dB lower, and whether or not the long path is there. I think you see where I'm going on that one, Bob. KD2, CGL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KD2, CGL. Yeah, makes sense. A quarter wave for a vertical on 80 meter, I mean on 160 is like, yeah, that is, you're right. Yeah, it probably would be better off to go with the wire antennas. Yet it just, 160 just gets so incredibly big that I agree with you that electronically resonating these wire antennas would probably be the best way to go. So thank you for answering my question, and well, this one guy did experience 80-meter long path, so I don't know about 160, but maybe it's possible to. So thank you for your answers, and this is KD2, CGL out.
Yeah, I guarantee the 160 long path is there. The only thing left to discuss is what percentage of the time is there, how many dB weaker is it. As long as you've got the right amount of power spread. In other words, if the guy you're listening to is transmitting enough power in the right direction with the right polarization during the correct status of the ionosphere and the D-layer absorption and the right situation as far as thunderstorms are concerned, you choose the right conditions, the right time, guarantee your long path is there on every single one of the HF bands. If you've got short path, guarantee you've got long path. Yes, a quarter wave ground plane antenna on 160 meters without top hat capacitors and whatever, it would have to be a tower 131 feet tall and a whole bunch of ground plane radials.